Sorry about that. I'm a little late starting the recording. We're going to be talking about the Flint crisis and sort of how it came about and what it tells us about how water systems in the United States are run and operated and regulated and so on. So some logistics to go over. So my guest is Shika Dalmia. She's a journalist that lives in Michigan, in the Detroit area. And so unfortunately, I looked on a map, and there's a lot of cities in Michigan that have high lead levels in their water. So it's a consistent problem in the state. And so Shika's sort of seen this up close and written a number of really good articles about what led to this, and digging a little deeper than I think a lot of the national press has done. And then I've been working on privatization and management and regulatory issues of water utilities for about 20 years. So the two of us are gonna talk for about 20, 25 minutes about some of the stuff that we see and think about this. And then we're gonna open it up to questions from all of you. Now, there's several ways you can ask questions, because we want people to be able to sort of shoot the question to me as soon as they think about it. And at the end, I will sort of read out the questions primarily, and so everyone can hear them unless you want to ask it on the phone. So one way you can ask questions is you can press *6 on your phone and then follow the prompts. I think after that you hit 1, and that puts you in a queue and gives me a little indicator that you want to ask a question. I can then unmute you and say, go ahead and ask your question. If my computer doesn't show your name, I'll just give the phone number. So be ready for that. If you want to ask a question as soon as it occurs to you, there are several ways you can do that. One, you can text me. Text 661-477-3107. Text me the question, and I'll repeat these numbers in the halfway through. You can tweet a question to me by tweeting, just tweeting to @@ Reason Policy, all one word, @ReasonPolicy. That will come up on feed. Or you can email me. I have all three of these things open. I can see any questions as they come in. My email is just adrian.moore@reason.org. So with that, we will go ahead and get started. So I've done radio shows, written articles about this Flint crisis since it broke. It's been a tragic but important story in highlighting some really fundamental issues about the way water is owned, water utilities, I should say, are owned and operated in the United States. And so just to make sure you guys all have kind of the run-up to the crisis straight in your minds, Shika, could you go ahead and kind of summarize that for everyone?
Yeah, sure. Thanks a lot, Adrian. Hello, everyone. So this crisis, as you all know, hit the headlines, the national headlines, earlier this year around January. But this had actually been brewing at a lower level in the Michigan press for a while, actually since about beginning of last year, when just very soon after Flint switched its water source. And the reason it switched actually thereby hangs a tale. So Flint used to get its water from the Detroit Water and Sewage Department, which is, you know, owned by the city of Detroit and operated by the city of Detroit. For many years, the Detroit Water and Sewage Department, it actually provides the drinking water for a big portion of Southeast Michigan where I live, including me, where I live in West Bloomfield. I get my water from the Detroit Water and Sewage Department. But the suburbs that had been getting water from Detroit had always been very, very, very unhappy with the management of this department and the fact that, you know, it was overpriced and they didn't really have any control in all the inefficiency and corruption in the in this department. Also, the department was unable to meet federal water quality requirements for a while, and it had actually been under court receivership for 35 years. But that's all as by way of background. Flint had, as some of the other suburbs in the area, had wanted to separate from the Detroit Water and Sewage Department for a long time. And about in 2011, it decided it was going to get its water from or it started exploring the idea of getting its water from this new water authority that was being created called the Karen Gandhi Water Authority. This was a very expensive project, but it was going to supply to this entire Genesee County area, which Flint is in, which Flint is located. Meanwhile, the Detroit Water and Sewage Department actually was, the court handed it over to this very competent woman called Susan McCormick, who came and she turned around this department completely, or at least for, you know, the interim that she was at the head of it. And she went back to Flint. Flint had not actually made any final decisions about where it was going to get its water. Went back to Flint and said that, hey, you know, we will give you very good rates. We'll cut our rates in half for you. And we will also give you representation on our water board. You will save $800 million over 30 years compared to going with this new authority. Flint, however, refused. And this is something that you will not hear in too much of the mainstream media, which is spinning this as a story of austerity. The mainstream narrative is that Flint kids got poisoned because Flint moved from a more expensive water source to a cheaper water source. Well, that actually is not the case. What happened was Flint went with a more expensive source, partly because as records are coming out, it saw this as actually a stimulus measure. It wanted local jobs. The Flint City Council and the Genesee Drain Commissioner and what have you saw this new pipeline as a stimulus measure. In any case, so the negotiations between Detroit and Flint broke down at some point, and Flint decided that it was, you know, simply not going to have anything to do with Detroit. However, before this new pipeline, the Karen Gandhi pipeline, came online, it would be about a year. That's when they made the fateful decision. Flint made the fateful decision to actually start drawing water from this mothball plant that used Flint River water. Flint River, for the longest time, had been literally, you know, a sewage for a local industry. GM and a lot of other plants that are in Flint, and Flint is kind of like an auto town, had been dumping effluents in Flint River. And the local authorities, along with the emergency manager, which the state had actually placed in Flint, because Flint was going bankrupt, just like Detroit was going bankrupt, decided that they were actually going to reopen this mothball plant. And this water turned out to be really bad water, and problems with this water started emerging last year. Immediately when Flint switched from Detroit to Flint River, residents started complaining, look, this water doesn't taste right, it doesn't look right, it doesn't smell right. Children were coming down with rashes, and the authorities kept assuring them that the water was just fine. There was a bacterial outbreak immediately, and that caused, you know, authorities to use more chlorine in the water, which itself was causing problem. The chlorine was actually causing a local GM auto plant's auto parts to corrode, but yet that water was still being given to residents. And at the same time as these, as the, you know, this excessive TTH, you know, this byproduct of the chlorine was finding its way into the drinking water supply, there was also concern at that point because of an outbreak of Legionnaire's disease, which is usually connected to lead poisoning, as well as some other symptoms that local residents were showing, that maybe there is also an additional lead poisoning issue. However, state tests that tested this water sample decided there was no lead poisoning issue. A state epidemiologist who found actually elevated lead levels in the bloodstreams of some children was dismissed as a season anomaly. And in fact, the mayor of Flint went on radio on the air and told Flint residents that, hey, there's nothing wrong with this water. We have tested it. Everything is fine. You'll be wasting your precious money on bottled water if you buy bottled water. My family and I, we are all drinking the same water, and there is nothing to fear. So that was like the public line that was coming to Flint residents. Meanwhile, actually, EPA, which is supposed to oversee Michigan and, you know, every water department in the country, one of their own employees who had taken some water samples and done some tests had said, look, I think there is an elevated lead issue over here. The governor's office had an aide who also was worried, and he asked the local DEQ if the lead level was elevated. They were all assured that there was really nothing to worry about. Finally, EPA actually, by last June, it was pretty clear EPA knew that independent tests were confirming that there was an elevated lead level, but the EPA actually did not make its concerns public. It did not warn the residents of Flint that maybe, hey, you have a lead problem, you're right about it. It basically kept telling the local DEQ, the Department of Environmental Quality, to communicate to the residents, and the DEQ, for purposes, you know, yet to be revealed, did not act soon enough. It was only in October last year when a university in Virginia and a local hospital did independent water tests and blood tests that just showed beyond any reasonable doubt that there was a more level than there should be in the water and in children's bloodstream, did the state start taking this whole thing very seriously. That's when, now, meanwhile, bear in mind, Flint was, as I said, under an emergency manager that was appointed by the state, by a Republican governor. And the Republican governor, it took him, I think, till about December to actually declare a state of emergency. And when he declared this emergency, the immediate media narrative became that it was the fault of this Republican governor who had placed this emergency manager, who wanted to cut corners as much as he could in terms of cost, and that's what caused the poisoning. What the media narrative misses is that, A, this was not actually a cost-saving measure. This was actually a stimulus measure that it would have cost the city only $45,000 a year to treat the water for lead, basically put phosphorus in the water, and that would have prevented the lead poisoning issue. So, you know, that was just two small potatoes for any government to be that cheap about. And that, and not fully facing up to the fact that there was like multiple levels of government failure, that the DEQ failed, the EPA failed, the Department of Health and Human Services failed, the state manager failed, the local mayor failed, and yes, the governor, the Michigan governor, also failed. So every agency is implicated in this, which to me shows the problem with what happens when you have government regulating other government agencies. And as if that is not enough to add insult to the injury of Flint residents, these residents, as you all know, can't sue the government because the government is protected by the doctrine of sovereign immunity. So that, well, in a nutshell, is what's going on over here.
All right, thanks. Yeah, that's I want to return to a couple of those last things in a few minutes, because the whole notion circles around. So the big takeaway, I think, from that is what you were saying towards the end there, that there was this succession of government failures that led to this, including in that sort of whole period where they were saying, we have testing that says everything is fine. Subsequent analysis of that testing has shown that there's the American Water Works Association basically has a standard manual of how you do these testings. It's pretty well understood, and the testing protocols that they used were completely out of whack with the accepted protocols for testing. So either there was incompetence in the testing process that led to them failing to understand that the problem was as bad as it was, or they didn't know how to get out of the pickle, and so they did their testing out of protocol in order to avoid revealing a problem that they didn't want to have to confront. I don't think we're going to know the answer to that, but
right. The
fact is they were basing their assurances on pretty obviously flawed information. So the other interesting thing about this, the way this all went down, is that a lot of people seem to be missing this lesson of the unwillingness of the EPA or the state authorities to really come down on the local government. And this is a story that plays out all over. I just read an article this morning in a very left-wing magazine describing how basically a bunch of other places around the country where a very similar pattern is going on, where the local authority has a water system that is out of compliance with standards. People are getting water that is not healthy, and the EPA is saying, you should fix that, and that's it. There's no real consequences. And it's really striking when you contrast this with the about 25% of the U.S. population that gets their water from a private water utility, either for the most part privately owned, but in a fair number of cases, municipally owned but privately operated water utility, where the regulators don't hesitate for a hot second to drop the hammer on any violation of standards. The relationship is so completely different in those cases, where the regulators really feel like, hey, our job is to test this stuff and to hold these guys accountable for the standards of which they have agreed to meet. And when it's a local government, it's our job is to let them know that they're in violation and hopefully they'll do the right thing. Changing a water utility, changing the technology, changing the infrastructure is a long, slow process. It's an expensive process. These water problems are really not very visible, which is why you need fairly technical testing to expose them. So there's a lot of incentives for these local agencies to be slow to respond. They don't have the money. They don't have easy access to the money. They have to go through an ugly political fight to get access to the money to upgrade their systems. People don't really know that there's a problem, and so there's not a lot of pressure on them. You can imagine how this leads to at least a lot of lag in acting, if not outright attempts to avoid acting. And so this is a repeated problem. And when you've got a privately owned or operated utility, you really have almost none of that. And in fact, I did a little research and just found quickly on Google, I could find a number of examples of private water utilities being heavily fined, being shut down, being closed and sold because they failed, a second time failing to meet standards. So the difference in consequences couldn't be more stark. And I find it interesting that so few of the discussions about what happened in Flint, could this happen somewhere else, really get down to that fundamental problem of incentive.
Right. I mean, yeah. Adrian, you've hit the nail on the head there. I mean, if you look at a lot of the liberal media stories on this, one of the themes that comes out repeatedly is that the Flint government has broken faith with its citizens, with its residents. And my response to it always is, you don't need faith. You need the government to have actually incentives to do the right thing, right? I mean, you don't keep faith with your private provider, you hold them accountable. And the problem, as you said, is, there is generally recognized that there's a problem of regulatory capture, even when the government is regulating private entities. But that problem of regulatory capture is compounded so many times because, first of all, there's a revolving door between these bureaucracies. So, a DEQ bureaucrat is looking for a job, in the EPA regional office or what have you. And these bureaucrats are very cozy with each other. They don't see their role as adversarial, which is the case, with a government regulator and a private company. There is no even pretense of any kind of adversarial relationship. They are supposed to actually get along. I mean, that's supposed to be the ethos, is that they are supposed to get along. And part of getting along means, and actually Susan Hedman, who is the regional head of the EPA, who was actually forced to resign after this scandal, I mean, she kept protesting, but look, we had to maintain these lines of communication, and there are roles and responsibilities that each agency has. We did not want to step on the Michigan DEQ's toes. And so why are you, coming after me? I mean, and this is a woman whose department, whose own analysis by its own, one of its own employees was showing that there were elevated lead levels, and she knew there were elevated lead levels, and yet she would not go public with the information. In fact, this employee had to leak his findings to the local ACLU, and then the ACLU went public with it, so it was a whistleblower who came out.
Right.
And reveal these findings. That's how we kind of found out that, this was kind of like the lead poisoning was a real issue.
Yeah, it's what your point about the incentives is right on target. These agencies don't have a there's not really an oversight relationship there. There's somewhat that revolving door issue that you mentioned, but just sort of broader culturally, they all feel like they're kind of on the same team,
right.
and that this not in the business of holding each other accountable. And we see this all over. When I think about, reasons policy work, I mean, there's got to be three or four things going on right now that are kind of big policy change issues where you have this fundamental problem that, the government pretty much deliberately has created a situation where they're basically regulating themselves, and so isn't that nice? Because regulating yourself is the best deal of all. The big debate going on in Washington now about splitting off air traffic control into a nonprofit from the FAA. A big part of the benefit of that is having the air traffic control system actually regulated by somebody that isn't themselves, the way it is right now. And so This is a common problem. Well, I want to go to some specific questions we're getting from folks in the audience. So let me just do a quick refresher. If you have a question at this point, you can hit *6, and it should and then follow the prompts, and it should I should be able to then get an indicator and unmute you to ask the question on the phone. If you want to text me the question at text me at 661-477-3107 or email me the question at adrian.moore@reason.org. And the other option is tweeting the question to at Reason Policy, at symbol Reason Policy, all one word. So I already have a few questions, so let me go. And this is one that I've heard a lot. Why can't Flint residents sue the government? Other governmental agencies like police departments get sued all the time. Shika, do you want to try to explain the application of sovereign immunity?
Yeah, so sovereign immunity is, is a doctrine that says that when the government is discharging its a core function and does something wrong in the course of discharging that core function, then it can't be sued. So, if it is laying pipes outside your house and there's a burst water pipe, well, there might be a lot of damage to your property, but you can't sue the government because it was discharging that function. The time when you can, the government can sometimes consent to be sued, but it's extremely, extremely rare. The only instances when you can sue the government is when you're suing it not as qua government, but as a qua an employer. So, for instance, if the United Postal Service is driving a truck and, the guy and the driver, USPS employee runs somebody over, then you can sue the postal, department as the employee of this driver. But you can't if the postal service misplaces some important mail that you're supposed to get, you can't really sue the postal department. And so it is, and in fact, there is a class action lawsuit here in Michigan, but the odds that they will be able to get any substantial tort compensatory damages is extremely, extremely unlikely. In fact, some of the biggest law firms in the country that deal with this kind of issue are not really touching this class action lawsuit because they just don't think it'll be a good use of their time given sovereign immunity.
Yeah, I mean, neither Sheik or I are lawyers, so there's probably more subtle explanations of this, but I've run into this issue in a lot of places, and a lot of times it comes down to basically government workers discharging their duty are really immune from personal liability. And so they have to, in a sense, step out of their duty. So a lot of times when police officers are sued, the thing that enables that to go forward is first showing that they violated, say, department rules or guidelines or something. So they were what they did was outside of their duty, and therefore they can be held liable for it. Or you can sometimes sue the agencies themselves for bad policies. So there may be room here for some lawsuits.
There is room.
Lawsuits against water agencies have a real low success track record.
Right. Yeah, let me just add to, there is room if you can show like reckless disregard and intention. And that's the burden. And that's what the lawsuit over here is trying to establish. But that's like a very, very high burden to meet. But, I just want to say, there is a good argument for sovereign immunity because ultimately, where is the government going to pay up any liability lawsuit from, but from taxpayers' bucket, right? That's where it gets from. So the whole doctrine of sovereign immunity is actually meant to protect taxpayers from, especially from frivolous lawsuits.
Yeah.
But, when
and
you
it's
have...
also designed, it's also designed to force the people who want change to go through the democratic process rather than, than using lawsuits. But yeah, that's a whole. We could have a whole call just about that because that's another issue of obviously the size and scope of government. Frankly, the more government does, the more of a problem or a necessity it is to have more tools to hold them accountable becomes. And the smaller their scope is, the less of a problem this is. I'm sure at the time of the founding, nobody thought this would be a big deal. But so I want to move on to the next question, which is from someone who actually lives in the Detroit area. The first question is why the issue about Flint turning down Detroit's revised offer has gotten so little press. I've seen it at Reason, but not locally. Do you have any thoughts on maybe why that whole first part of the story where they turned down Flint's offer hasn't seen much local press?
Well, you know, it was covered at that time, you know, when 2 years ago when Flint, 3 years ago when it turned it down, it actually at that point it did get a lot of local press. Since then, I think there are a couple of things. One, everybody thinks that, you know, so that's kind of like a moot issue. It's a done deal. Which would be fine if then they didn't keep spinning this austerity, you know, narrative. Then if they didn't want to go there then, you know, and didn't want to reopen that whole issue, it would be fine. I think the other issue is, you know, it's kind of like one of those very contested things. It's like there's a lot of he said, she said. And, you know, local reporters just don't want to get into that. I mean, I think there's partly it's kind of like laziness. Partly I think they like the explanation that they have, which is right. That, you know, it's all the fault of this big bag, the evil Republican governor who, you know, and Snyder has a reputation for being a pragmatic businessman who brings this, you know, cost-cutting mentality to government. And they like, I mean, and so they've got kind of got their villain and they don't want to go there. And frankly, you know, when I wrote my first piece on Flint, I did not know at that time that that Flint had actually opted for the more expensive water source, arguably. And it was only I have some very good sources, you know, who after they read my first piece actually got in touch with me and showed me these studies that were conducted that were commissioned by the state treasurer at that time from an independent engineer company that had given estimates as to why this was, you know, sticking with Detroit would cost less. I should just add one thing. I mean, you know, there are rational reasons for the suburbs to be suspicious of Detroit. I mean, Detroit has been a horribly, horribly managed entity, and there are real fears that down the road, entities that are relying on it from water will be hit with massive rate hikes because there are massive upgrades that they have to do. So there's going to be a lot of bonds to service and what have you. And some of the local communities over here actually have formed their own Great Lakes Water Authority and found, you know, membership on the Detroit board in order to protect themselves and insulate themselves.
And that's, you know,
rate hikes.
And that's exactly, you know, what I was thinking when all of this came out is that, you know, they presented it as this either-or option. So we have this agency that we get water from. We have a horrible relationship. They have a horrible track record. We hate them. We want to get away from them. So we're going to take this deal to go to this other water source. Now, that water is not going to be available for 8 years, but we're going to make that decision now, and we're not going to think about what to do for the next 8 years is basically the decision they made. Instead of doing something rational like saying, okay, Detroit, that is a pretty good deal. Now, we don't believe that in the long run you guys are going to be reliable because you never have been before. But if we can get a contract right now for, say, 8 years of water at that deal, we'll take it, but no longer than that because we're going to be working on our own different long-term water source from this other agency. That might have made sense, but they didn't do that. And so they went to this known bad source of water. And that's the thing is, they knew there was huge risks in opening up that water plant, but they felt like they didn't have any option. No sign that they went back to Detroit and said, oh, gosh, you know, now maybe we, you know, at least in the short run, we should take a deal of water from you. None of the things that they should have been doing if they had been, you know, operating under proper incentives in any fashion really happened.
So, you know, just to add to that, the thing that was different about Flint and some of the other areas around Flint, which were also switching to this new water authority, but they kept getting water from Detroit in the interim. The difference was that Flint had this local water plant, right? And this local water plant, it was supposed to be a backup system in cases of emergency, like, you know, you have some unexpected situation where water is cut off and you can turn to this supply. It's supposed to be very temporary and really emergency. They decided, because they had this backup option, that they would just use it because that would be cheaper. They thought that would be cheaper. So that's what the media is kind of spinning as an austerity thing, forgetting that that doesn't make any sense, because over a course of 30 years, Flint was potentially paying $800 million more. So a few million dollars over a course of 2 years really didn't save it a whole lot.
They weren't making overall decisions to save money. Well, let me go to one more, let me see, another question. So let's see, I'm trying to reword this question. Basically, did they originally consider privatization when they were looking at this Detroit versus the other water authority question? Because a lot of the privatization that's happened around the country has been driven by a desire to improve the quality of water, to meet environmental standards. So did they even think about that?
Well, yes. I mean, they did, and I was actually looking into this just last week, and I did not get very, very firm answers to it. Privatizing the Detroit water system has been discussed frequently, actually. It is not going to happen, and, you know, actually Len Gilroy, our other colleague, can talk more to that. And the reason is that the Detroit Water and Sewage Department has been so badly managed, and there are already existing bond costs that, you know, still have to be retired, and on top of that, new bonds have to be issued in order to get, you know, in order for future upgrades. So this is like billions of dollars of investment, but the Detroit population itself is really shrinking. And so the fear of private companies, you can't really find private takers for Detroit. The reason is because they just fear they will never be allowed to charge the kinds of rates that they will have to, you know, they will have to in order to recover their cost and meet their risk in order to, you know, for this to be a viable option. So for that reason, actually, the whole management of the Detroit Water and Sewage Department was changed, with Detroit keeping a portion of it and the Great Lakes Water Authority leasing another portion of it, you know, that supplies the suburbs, and they are going to handle that, and also getting a seat on the board to protect themselves from any rate hikes that are coming down the pipeline, which, let me just point out, is going to be horrible for Detroit residents, because Detroit is not exactly, you know, a flourishing city right now, and these residents are poor, but they are really facing very, very high rate increases down the road, and that's basically because Detroit has been so poorly managed.
Yeah, and that barrier in Detroit, we've obviously gone around a few times about that, or, you know, in Detroit trying to push that idea and fighting that uphill battle. I mean, they've got themselves in such a pickle that it's hard for anybody to finance them getting out of it. I think the Flint itself could have looked at some options there, but it's not obvious that a private company coming in there could necessarily have solved their immediate water supply problems, other than maybe in some kind of long-term deal they could have rehabbed or replaced the Flint River plant you know, in some way to sort of bridge that 8-year gap. So probably new ideas would have been brought to the table if they brought the private sector in at some point, but
Right, but in the interim, I mean, there was nothing hard, there was nothing wrong with Flint continuing to get its water from Detroit. It was actually just a few years. It wasn't really 8 years. And, you know, that's what it should have done. The problem there was, again, government incompetence, that they grossly underestimated both that the cost involved, the economics of, you know, turning this the Flint River into a good water source, and the scientific expertise that was needed in order to do that. I mean, look, they didn't even think of treating this water for phosphorus, which is the which is required. I mean, they didn't even think of doing that. So they clearly didn't have the know-how. And what they were doing was depending upon the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality to be kind of like, you know, the scientific and the technological consultant for the Flint River water. But, you know, these people are bureaucrats. They, you know, they can tell you what the EPA tells them to do. They don't have any independent scientific expertise. So, you know, they just completely, I mean, that's the part which is, you know, which just really dismays me, that is not getting enough attention, is just how much the local authorities and the DEQ and the Michigan governor, I mean, that was his problem, was they totally underestimated the scientific expertise that would be required to, you know, do a cost-effective job of cleaning up the Flint River.
Right. Yeah, though I would say that between the EPA and the State Department, DEQ, and the authorities' own people, the knowledge of treating water for lead, I mean, that's not real obscure esoteric knowledge. I mean, I think they just weren't even at that point looking there. I don't know what bigger fish they felt they had to fry, but, you know, again, there was a huge incentive problem to you know, trying to deal with this problem in sort of what would be the protocol ways of dealing with it in most situations.
Right.
I want to go to one more question, and then I think we're going to be getting close to the end of our time. We can go a little longer if we get more questions. So this is basically about comparing water costs between different authorities or an authority and a private company managing it. The questioner says he's dug into trying to get information on the pricing of water and sewer in a number of different locations, trying to understand the costs at these authorities, and that getting that information is extraordinarily hard, and that he's seen some papers that in Europe there's a lot of data on performance metrics of water quality and costs at water utilities that we don't seem to have here. I think that's basically very true. Having done research on this issue on the cost of delivering water for 20 years now, getting the data is extraordinarily difficult, not least because these water authorities basically, I mean, they operate virtually on a cash accounting basis. There isn't the kind of accounting that you would need to really understand costs. They don't really take into account, you know, they don't treat their wholesale supplies right. They don't treat their debt right. They don't treat their liabilities, their asset, their infrastructure liabilities the way a private company does. So whenever we've gotten involved in trying to compare costs between usually we're talking about a current public authority or utility operation and a potential private operator, there's a lot of number crunching that has to be done, and often sort of new information generated by analysis rather than it existing. You would like to think, you'd like to think the water authority would want to present clear, crisp information about how it uses ratepayers' money to provide them with their water. But if you think that, boy, are you an optimist, because I haven't seen it done pretty much anywhere. And instead, you get sort of a standard kind of government budget accounting where lots of stuff is wadded up into the same line item, that nothing is broken out, and really trying to figure out where the costs are is tricky. From doing these public-private comparisons, though, we know a few things. One of the biggest differentials between public and private water utility operations is staffing. Public water utilities are just outrageously overstaffed. I know you're all shocked that a government agency overstaffs. But in a number of studies conducted in a number of different states, it's seen the same results over and over again, going back to the early 90s. that when you finally get down to brass tacks, and even in one case we had a study where two water utilities side by side who got their water from the same source. So it was a government entity that wholesaled them the water. All they did was the retail, and you had a big difference in the rates they charged. The private one was much cheaper. Why? Because they had almost half the staff per connection that the government agency had. Lo and behold, they have. And what goes along with that is that they're often much more able to get the latest training for their people, to adopt the latest technologies, especially if they're cost-saving technologies. And to be fair, it's for a private company to make an investment to save costs is just a management decision. For a government agency to make an investment in, say, new technology that would save money is actually a huge political fight. They have to go to the elected officials and say, hey, we want you to approve a rate increase so that we can pay for putting in this new system that will save money in the long run, but we have to pay for the technology up front. That almost never flies, and so the elected officials, you say, nah, rather than taking the political hit for raising rates right now, we'll just not save that money because that's not visible, but the rate increase is visible to the voters. So, again, the incentives, even in something as I don't want to say mundane as that, but not having to do with people's lives and safety the way contamination does, the incentives are all wrong. So I think the bottom line everyone can take away from this is that this has been another great example of how, the government does a terrible job of regulating itself, that the process of holding all of these, myriad services that governments provide accountable via the democratic process is a very clunky, unwieldy thing compared to the way that we hold people we buy products and services from in the private market accountable. And that even though there are literally thousands of examples of water utilities around the country, thousands and thousands, I should say, where the private sector is doing a great job and not suffering these kinds of problems consistently, decade after decade, it's still an uphill push to get these local agencies to consider this. It does happen. Just last year, the city of Rialto in California, not quite in as dire a situation as Flint, but they had a necessity to build a lot of new infrastructure in order to comply with standards. And it wasn't an emergency yet, but they knew it was going to have to happen, and it was going to cost a lot of money. And so it took them a couple of years of arguing about it, but ultimately they decided to go with a private company coming in, taking over operations, making those investments, and saving them a lot of money and providing a consistency and quality that they probably could not have achieved as keeping it as a city department. So these decisions do get made out there, just not nearly often enough, and certainly not often enough in Michigan, where water quality problems are pretty rampant. So, privatization rules is, I guess, the bottom line. I want to thank all of you for joining us. The transcript of this will be posted on reason.org, and it usually takes us about a week to get it up there, along with the transcripts of our past telebriefings, so feel free to check those out and watch your email for the invitation to the next one. That'll be coming in about three to four weeks from now. Again, thanks, Sheikha. Thank you very much for joining us, and thanks all of you for listening, and have a great week.